Okay, the year Donald Trump left office, 2021, Deutsche Bank commissioned a highly confidential appraisal of one of his properties, the Trump National Golf Club in Doral, Florida. Thanks to the New York Attorney General's civil fraud lawsuit, that highly confidential document is now public. And the findings in it were not great for Donald Trump. The Trump brand has negatively impacted Doral's performance. This has been due to numerous statements made by Donald Trump when he was running for and after he became president. Mr. Trump is a polarizing figure who ignites strong feelings from both supporters and supporters of his political opponents. This resulted in many groups canceling events at the property and has kept the resort from achieving results commensurate with the facility. So the Trump brand was toxic to half the country, and therefore Doral Golf Course was in trouble. The ex-president needed a way to make his golf course profitable, and he found it with the help of an old friend.
Describe Doral in one word. Brutal.
Tough.
Challenging.
Tricky.
Treacherous.
Yeah.
Monster. When you win at Doral, you earn it, and it feels good.
That was the ad for the controversial LIV Golf Tournament, a new golf league funded by the government of Saudi Arabia. LIV actually stands for the Roman numeral 54, the total number of holes played at each tournament, but for some reason they keep calling it LIV. I don't know. At any rate, this week, professional golfers and fans are flocking to Trump's Doral Golf Course thanks to the generous support of the Saudi regime. And the public is totally in the dark about how much money Trump and his businesses are getting from a foreign government that murdered an American journalist named Jamal Khashoggi on President Trump's watch. But the LIV Golf Tournament is just one of the ways that Saudi Arabia is lining the pockets of Donald Trump and his family. Remember that right after Trump left office, the Saudis gave an unprecedented $2 billion to the investment firm of Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. It is all part of the incredibly opaque web of financial arrangements that Trump and his family have entered into, arrangements that have significant implications for the country as Trump tries to pay off his numerous legal debts while running for president. And Trump may need that foreign cash more than ever. One of the ways Trump was expected to pay for his mounting legal bills was through his Twitter knockoff, Truth Social. Last month, Trump took that company public, and thanks to investments from Trump's loyal supporters, the value of his shares rose to more than $4 billion, despite the fact that Truth Social is losing money and has fewer users than any social media company that has ever gone public before. Since then, Trump's stock has literally been in free fall. The company has already lost more than $2 billion of value since that first day of trading. It lost 10% of its value just today, its worst day of trading yet, which may not be a great sign for a stock that has been shorted by a lot of its major investors. But that's not the only problem with Trump's media company. Trump first launched Truth Social with the help of two former apprentice contestants who became his business partners. Those two former apprentice contestants have now sued Trump, alleging that Trump was trying to cheat them out of their share of the profits from Truth Social. And that lawsuit has taken an interesting turn. On April 15th, Trump will have to sit for a deposition in the case brought by those two ex-business partners, which is notable, not just because the notoriously untruthful president will once again have to give testimony under oath. It is also notable because April 15th is the scheduled start date for Trump's criminal hush money trial here in Manhattan. Happy tax day! Now, Trump has been doing everything he can to try and stop that trial in its tracks. Today, Trump asked the judge overseeing that case, Judge Juan Marchand, to recuse himself, arguing that he can't get a fair trial because the judge's daughter is a political consultant who has worked with Democratic candidates in the past. This is actually the second time Trump has made this argument. It did not work last time, and this trial does not appear to be slowing down. Today, CBS News reports that more than 500 New Yorkers have already been sent notices to appear as potential jurors in this historic trial, which means we are now just 10 days away from Donald Trump, a former American president, actually standing trial as a criminal defendant for the very first time. Joining me now is Christy Greenberg, a former federal prosecutor and former deputy chief of the criminal division for the Southern District of New York. Christy, thanks for joining me. Every day, it's like I get a mini lesson in law, like going to have a law degree by 2027. I get a little small lesson in how it all works. But the jury selection process, I think that there's a lot about it that people don't know. And this one in particular is going to be historic, right? Just big picture, how difficult is it going to be to select a jury in Manhattan that doesn't know that much about what Trump's been up to?
So it's fine if the jury knows what he's been up to. I mean, you kind of have to be living under a rock not to know that he's running and that he has called the various cases against him a witch hunt. But the question really for both sides is, can they put whatever opinions they have about Donald Trump, the candidate, or what they've heard about this case in the press, can they put that aside and just evaluate the instructions on the law and the evidence that they are going to hear at the trial? Can they put aside what their preconceived notions are and be impartial? That's really the question. And so you can expect in a case like this an even more detailed questioning of these potential jurors. A lot about their backgrounds, a lot about what have you heard? Have you heard Trump's statements blasting Alvin Bragg and calling him an animal and all these terrible things? And what do you think about
that? Do you read the newspaper?
I mean, what newspapers do you read? Where do you get your news from? And how has it affected your opinions? Can you put opinions that you have aside and listen to the evidence? Those are the kinds of questions that both sides will really be asking.
There, CBS News reports that they're going to be using jury specialists to find jurors. For people who don't know what a jury specialist is, what do they do exactly?
They're basically going to stalk the jurors and learn everything they can about them. Learn, you know, their backgrounds. What have they been doing on social media? Do they have opinions on politics, on this president, on these cases that they have expressed at any point? And just generally, what are their backgrounds? I mean, certain backgrounds of individuals, you know, whether people have families, whether they have established employment, there are certain kinds of witness jurors that you're going to look for as a prosecutor that you may want to sit. Jurors that that have sat before and they haven't been able to reach a verdict on a case, that's kind of a red flag. Prosecutors. Those who don't really trust the government and, you know, believe a lot of disinformation. One of the questions that the prosecutors want to ask is, do you believe the election was stolen?
Right.
Hugely important question, because if you believe that, then you're somebody who's unlikely to really buy much of what the prosecution is going to be arguing.
These jury specialists, just to put a fine point on it, are like in the courtroom as the jurors are being called, right? I believe, just to take a trip down memory lane, there was a film in 2003 based on a John Grisham book, and it was called Runaway Jury. And this is a highly dramatized depiction of what these jury specialists do, I think. Can we please roll the tape?
Dolores Kennelly, registered Democrat, 46 years of age, unmarried occupational therapist, devout cat lover.
Yeah, look at the way she turns away from the man walking her stomach.
Ricky Coleman, 36 years of age, her husband's a Baptist minister. She's a card-carrying member of the Sierra Club and a registered Democrat.
I hate Baptists almost as much as I hate Democrats.
Look at the way she turns away from the man walking the stock. I mean, that kind of granularity seems for Hollywood, but I mean, obviously, if you believe the 2020 election was stolen, that's a tell, right? And that's a controversial question to ask. But like, I would imagine that the vetting process is similar to sort of the targeted campaign outreach that they make to voters. Like, certain habits, reading habits, job industries are going to be tells for certain political proclivities, right?
Right. And, you know, are you affiliated with certain associations? And that doesn't mean necessarily are you a Democrat or a Republican, even how you voted. That's pretty much off limits, or it should be off limits, though Trump's team wants those questions. What kind of associations do you are you affiliated with? Yeah, where do you get your news from? And more importantly, are you somebody who's going to be more susceptible to conspiracy theories, to not buying what the government is arguing? Those are the kinds of things that consultants looking at your background can get a pretty good sense of.
And they don't want stealth jurors either, right? Because there are a lot of people out there on the left and on the right who know the historical import of this and just want to be jurors and could theoretically mask themselves as kind of impartial or unknowing potential candidates for the jury.
Right. And that is what is going to keep DA Bragg up at night.
Yeah.
Because on most cases, you have people who are trying to find any excuse not to sit on the jury. They are really doing their best. And you know those people that, you know, any question, their hand is up. They've got something to say. They need a sidebar with the judge. Like, you can tell those people. Here, I think that's going to be less of the issue because it is such a historic case. This is the first criminal trial involving a president. And you can see people, even if they think the answer is yes, the election was stolen, well, I know why they're asking that, and I really want to be seated, so I'm not going to tell you what I really think. And that's where jury consultants, I think, really will be important.
Particularly Gene Wilder is needed,
yes,
and all of his computer screens. But I mean, you know, there's a threat that Judge Marchand has put out there, right? In the context of expanding this gag order to include Marchand's family members, in the context of making these very articulate arguments for what Donald Trump is doing to the rule of law and why he needs to be, you know, gagged, for lack of a better term. He has also said that if Trump continues to mouth off, if he continues to destroy the integrity or attempt to destroy the integrity of those involved in this prosecution, he will lose access to the jurors' names. That means, can you just clarify what that means and the significance of that?
So this is the real sanction out of that gag order. This is the real thing that I think Trump and his lawyers probably looked at and said, oh, okay, maybe we have to get it, shut him up and make sure that he complies with this, which is why I think you're seeing actually the very attacks on the judge's daughter now being taken up by his lawyers as an end run around that gag order. But this sanction is important because the prosecutors, they would have access to the jury's name. They would get to do all that background research on these jurors, whereas Trump and his team would not know their names. They would only know the answers to the questions. They wouldn't really be able to fact check by doing the research and knowing, okay, like, let's Google, let's look at their social media, let's do all of that research. They wouldn't have the names to be able to do that.
That's a big deal, right? Because I, again, from courtroom dramas, starring Gene Hackman, not Gene Wilder. I do know. I mean, I think all of us have seen the way in which the prosecution and the defense both create sort of profiles in their minds as they're developing their arguments and thinking about what they're going to say about the men and women that they're talking to. And if you don't know other than the responses to their questions, that seems like you're really fighting with one hand tied behind your back.
Yes, it would be a huge disadvantage. And so I think given that, you're going to see at least Donald Trump try to stay just within the boundaries of that gag order, that he is pushing the limits even by reposting what other people are posting.
Yeah, and that's just, I mean, the climate, the relationship that this defense already has with this judge seems so poisoned that I would imagine, you know, it's not unobvious. It's not the most subtle thing to say. That seems problematic, right? That is not, I mean, it seems like a big, big deal that they have this hugely antagonistic relationship with the judge that's presiding over this case.
They do. And in most cases, you wouldn't see a criminal defendant who try to antagonize the judge who, if he is convicted, will end up sentencing him. That's not a dynamic you typically see. Maybe after the conviction, you have some words, or after a sentencing, you're upset and you want to appeal, but not before. But again, he is trying to do a number of things. He wants to delay the trial. He wants to distract from his conduct so that everybody is just focused on these attacks and these frivolous filings. We're not talking about what he actually did. And mass disruption. That is the third aspect of what he's trying to do. Intimidate jurors, intimidate witnesses, get people to maybe not show up or not say things that will be bad to him. I mean, he's really just trying to delegitimize the entire process. And this judge, I think, has really done a good job of trying to just, you know, stay the course and, you know, really not get emotional and just try to, you know, give rulings that are fair.
Yeah, in the name of justice. Thank you for watching old John Grisham clips with me on this Friday night, Christy. I appreciate your time and expertise on this topic. We have a lot more to get to this evening, including the latest on two of Trump's loyal foot soldiers in Congress receiving subpoenas in Arizona's investigation into the sprawling 2020 fake electors plot. But first, RFK Jr. today tried to clarify whether he thinks January 6th was a big deal. And he dug himself maybe just a little bit deeper. The New York Times' Michelle Goldberg joins me right here in studio to discuss right after the break.
Hey, Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
It's Monday night.
It's Monday, everyone. Happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC.
Monday night.
The third-party group No Labels this week announced it will not run a presidential candidate in the 2024 election. CEO Nancy Jacobson explained the group couldn't find anyone willing to run who had a credible path to winning the White House. This is after No Labels tried and failed to recruit former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, and Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. So with a potential threat from No Labels now neutralized, the biggest potential spoiler in the 2024 presidential race is Robert Kennedy Jr., a candidate who has been garnering almost 10% support in the latest national polls. Given his impact here, Kennedy is increasingly coming under scrutiny, which so far does not seem to be helping his campaign. This week, his campaign sent out a round of fundraising emails that called January 6th rioters activists. This then forced Kennedy to release a statement today clarifying his stance on the Capitol riot, which was no less alarming. In the statement, Kennedy writes that reasonable people, including Trump opponents, tell me there is little evidence of a true insurrection. Kennedy then had to redact part of the statement because the original version had said falsely that the protesters had no weapons, which was false. That part was later redacted and amended to read, several rioters have been convicted of carrying firearms into the Capitol building. Joining me now is Michelle Goldberg, New York Times columnist. She has been busy covering RFK Jr. and has a new, very illuminating piece in the New York Times called Terrified Parents, New Age Health Nuts, MAGA Exiles, Meet the RFK Jr. Faithful. I found this very eye-opening, Michelle. A delicious read as well. You talk about the way in which, you know, he's seen as a spoiler for Biden. Mm-hmm. But the people in the crowd at the RFK event that you went to had a pretty Trumpy bent. Can you talk a little bit more about, you know, the substantive sort of person, like campaign hires and positions he's taken right now that smack more of Trumpism than Bidenism.
So his campaign itself is increasingly Trumpy. I think before he seemed to straddle this kind of left-right heterodox eccentric space, but he's increasingly, for example, on issues that the left really cares about, like Israel-Palestine, he's actually more hawkish on Israel than Biden is. He has a reputation as an environmentalist, and he's very concerned about pollution. But when you actually look at his campaign, what he says is that environmental regulation is part of the same plot for totalitarian control as COVID measures. And so he's very libertarian. He says he wants free market solutions. And so there's not a lot in this campaign for left-wing people who are disillusioned with Joe Biden. I mean, some of them are going to vote for him anyway because there's a certain sort of person who's just anti-establishment who wants to vote for the anti-system candidate. Yes. And he is very much that. And it's why there was, you know, some interesting people had very interesting voting histories. You know, so for example, one person in my piece had voted for Jill Stein in 2016. He had voted for Andrew Yang in the primary in 2020 when Andrew Yang didn't win. He voted for Donald Trump. Mm. You know, so the kind of ideology was all over the place, but definitely more people who had either voted for Trump or would vote for Trump if Kennedy wasn't on the ballot than people who were even thinking about voting for Biden.
What's so great about the piece is that you really get at the strange brew of Trumpism as that part of the sort of far right meets another part of the far left. I'll read an excerpt. There's something distinctly Trumpy in Kennedy's campaign mix of new age individualism, social media fueled paranoia, and intense aching nostalgia for the optimistic America of the early 1960s. I think the right is understanding this, that the sort of potent brew there. Mm-hmm. And Sean Hannity has been taking time out of his very important programming to talk about Robert F. Kennedy in unfavorable terms. This is what he said last night.
On the issue of Kennedy, well, he is what he is. He is a devout radical environmentalist who frequently was heaping praise on Bernie Sanders and his radical Green New Deal. Here's another proposal that, well, bleeding heart liberals will find very tempting. Kennedy wants to slash the U.S. military budget and use the money for socialized health care.
Do you think Kennedy's latest kerfuffle, which is being euphemistic about it, about January 6th being a true insurrection or not, does that smack to you of political opportunism in a way to curry favor with Trump supporters? Or do you think that that is genuine, like, skepticism about whether
no,
it was really right?
I think that he genuinely basically is so paranoid about the federal government that it will take the side of whoever he feels like, you know, is kind of against the federal government. But he has a lot of Trump people around him. I mean, it really bears repeating that his head of communications, this guy Del Bigtree, was in Washington on January 6th, speaking at the MAGA Freedom Rally. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of just very right-wing people around him. At one point, his campaign was being run by Dennis Kucinich, this kind of eccentric left-wing congressman. But he's gone under dubious, you know, there's controversy about why he left, but he's hinted at disagreement over Israel and Gaza. There's just a lot of right-wing people around Kennedy. And so it's possible, I think, that he just has a lot of genuinely right-wing views. And then there's this other space in the sort of alternative health world where right and left intersect, but increasingly
the anti-vax stuff, the new age, like anti-pharma, new age, holistic medicine.
Right, which I think used to be very left-coded, but and always had a libertarian, individualistic strain to it. And there was always kind of some very right-wing people who were anti-vax, obsessed with natural living. But the center of gravity in that world has moved right over the course of the pandemic in opposition to vaccines and lockdowns. And meanwhile, the right itself, or at least the kind of esoteric edges of the right, has become increasingly obsessed with, you know, healthy living, the curative powers of sunlight and the like.
Yes. And you mentioned,
and, you know, I'm all for sunlight, but
morning sunlight in the words of his vice presidential nominee. I do want to talk about, this is not to dismiss the threat that he could potentially pose to Biden. And I think you really nail it in the piece when you're quoting Sarah Longwell, who has just been such a genius about so much campaign electoral related dynamics. My experience over the years in the focus group, she says, is that when Trump is top of mind for people who dislike both him, as in Trump, and Biden, end up disliking Trump more. Kennedy, she said, could give people who might otherwise reluctantly vote for Joe Biden an off-ramp for making a dispiriting decision.
Right. And so far, I think that's been the assumption among both Democrats and Republicans. You know, the biggest donor to Trump, one of Trump's super PACs, is also the biggest donor to the main pro-Kennedy super PAC. And I think he's doing that because he assumes that Kennedy is going to be a spoiler for Trump. And then meanwhile, the DNC has been very focused on Kennedy, assuming that he'll be a spoiler. Kennedy himself has said that he thinks Biden is more of a threat to democracy than Trump.
But
the other side of that is that who's attracted to that? Right. Who's attracted to that message? It's not someone who, for whom Biden is their second choice.
Right. This is the strange sort of mechanics of the Robert F. Kennedy campaign and candidacy. And I think you really add a lot to our understanding of it in this great piece out in The New York Times, which is coming out this weekend.
Thank
Michelle,
you.
It's great to see you. Thanks for your time tonight. We have more ahead this evening, including right-wing outrage theater revealed live in prime time on Fox News. But first, new reporting on Arizona's investigation into the 2020 fake elector plot shows that it is extending all the way into the halls of Congress. That is coming up next.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Go beyond the headlines with the new MSNBC app. Get real-time analysis from live blogs to in-depth essays, video highlights from your favorite shows, and the latest updates on the 2024 election. Visit msnbc.com/app to download.
Donald Trump may have stalled the federal criminal trial related to his 2020 election subversion, but state investigations into the fake electors plot are moving right along. Despite recent setbacks, the Fulton County, Georgia case against Trump and his allies and fake electors is still alive. In Nevada, a grand jury has indicted six fake electors. Michigan's attorney general has filed charges against 16 fake electors. And now Politico reports Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays appears close to announcing indictments in the investigation in her state. Kyle Cheney reports that Mays has subpoenaed two Arizona Republican congressmen, Andy Biggs and Paul Gosar, two of Trump's most loyal congressional allies, to testify before a grand jury. Now, remember, both of those men attended a strategy meeting at the White House prior to January 6th to discuss how Vice President Mike Pence could block the certification of election results. Both Biggs and Gosar also voted to overturn the 2020 election results after the attack on the Capitol. Joining me now is Kyle Cheney, senior legal affairs reporter at Politico. Kyle, thank you for being here. I feel like this is a very interesting turn of events. Now, give me your expectation about Biggs and Gosar actually cooperating with this subpoena. And could you tell us what else you know about the level of seriousness with which the AG in Arizona may actually be pursuing them?
Sure. So just in the big picture sense, it would not shock me if we saw charges in this investigation as early as next week. We understand it's fairly imminent. This is kind of a sleeper case in that we don't really know, is the AG purely focused on the false electors themselves, or is she looking at a level or two beyond them, you know, stretching into the Trump campaign, the Trump White House? And now, as we see, these two members of Congress who, yes, they played a role in what happened in Arizona, but they're meeting with Donald Trump, too. They're meeting with people in the national scope of this. So we don't quite know what she views as her, sort of how wide her aperture is, and whether she views people like that as targets or not, and whether people like Biggs and Gosar would comply with a subpoena like that. They have legal options to fight that. And we don't know. We don't have a lot of insight into whether they're employing those.
Yeah, I mean, I would say one of the enduring mysteries of the January 6th insurrection was, how come nobody's following the breadcrumbs all the way to the U.S. Congress, right? I mean, the president, former president, there's a federal criminal case against him, the fake electors, the middlemen here, congressmen like Biggs and Gosar, who apparently were involved in some of the, you know, planning of all this, have yet to face any serious scrutiny. I'm old enough to remember, Kyle, when Cassidy Hutchinson testified to the committee and said that these guys wanted pardons. Let's play that sound.
Are you aware of any members of Congress seeking pardons?
I guess Mr. Gates and Mr. Brooks, I know, have both advocated for there to be a blanket pardon for members involved in that meeting.
They all contact you?
Not all of them, but several of them did.
So you mentioned Mr. Gates, Mr. Brooks.
Mr. Biggs did. Mr. Jordan talked about congressional pardons, but he never asked me for one. It was more for an update on whether the White House is going to pardon members of Congress. Mr. Gomer asked for one as well. Mr. Perry asked for a pardon too, I'm sorry.
Kyle, the list keeps going on, right? Matt Gaetz, Mo Brooks, Andy Biggs, Jim Jordan, Louie Gohmert, Scott Perry. I mean, and yet none of these guys has really faced accountability as yet or serious questions from law enforcement officials. And I just wonder, give me a sense of sort of the complications of potentially prosecuting or at least charging a member of Congress as you see it.
I mean, look, there are a few challenges with that. I mean, we do know that Scott Perry had his phone seized by federal investigators as part of their look at Donald Trump and that broader plot. You know, he was a key player in the effort by Donald Trump to deploy the Justice Department to help do what he did in 2020. And so now, he wasn't charged over that. And we don't know where that path led DOJ. But it's hard to penetrate Congress. They have speech or debate protection in the Constitution, mm-hmm. basically almost a full immunity from being criminally pursued over their official business. Now, the January 6th session of Congress, even though it's about an election, is part of Congress's official business. They are casting votes to certify an election. So getting inside that and compelling these people to talk or to get even just to get a look at what they were doing and talking about is very difficult for investigators because of the protections built into the Constitution about it.
I will say, though, there was a lot of back and forth about whether Lindsey Graham would have to testify. He invoked speech and debate. He ultimately did in the Fulton County case. And I wonder if you think the tide is turning on that, given the egregious nature of what had transpired on January 6th, the testified role that some of these individuals played in it, and the fact that they asked for pardons, you know, after the fact, suggesting, I don't know, a cognizance of guilt. Do you think that the dynamic is changing in terms of how immune these guys are, in, you know, the blanket immunity? It seems they might have had in years past.
Lindsey Graham is a great example because he was ordered to testify, but under very strict conditions where they said you can only ask him about things that had nothing to do with his work as, you know, the Judiciary Committee chairman or as a senator. Ask him about his contacts with the Trump campaign. That's not official business. You could get to something like that for a Gosar or a Biggs, but it takes a lot of work in the courts. Lindsey Graham went all the way to the Supreme Court with that. It took months. So that's still, it's still an onerous thing for a prosecutor to do.
It's a long road. It's a winding road, but maybe it is a road worth walking down in the name of protecting democracy. Just putting it out there. Kyle Chaney, always great with such bombshell and essential reporting. Thanks for your time tonight, Kyle.
Thank you, Alex.
Coming up, are you old enough to remember when conservatives hated Bud Light? I am. It was last year. We're going to check out the latest act in conservative outrage theater coming up next.
Let me say something to all you and be as clear and concise as possible.
That was Kid Rock. 1 year and 2 days ago, shooting at cans of Bud Light with an automatic rifle to show his disgust that the company had sent a trans social media influencer named Dylan Mulvaney some promotional material for an Instagram ad. The entire conservative world went like haywire after that. But Kid Rock really led the charge in calling for a boycott of Bud Light. Again, that was literally almost exactly a year ago. And then this was Kid Rock last night on Fox.
Now I see you're wearing is that a Budweiser hat? Like, it was a year ago, right? That you famously posted that video of I think he was shooting some Bud Light cans after the Dylan Mulvaney controversy. So you've lightened up on Bud Light.
This is a cool hat. I don't know. Man, that is just, man, we got, I didn't know what hat I was wearing.
It's a cool hat. Now, none of the performed outrage here was ever actually about Bud Light. Despite calling for a boycott, the bar Kid Rock owned still served Bud Light. Kid Rock himself was caught drinking Bud Light just months after shooting cases of it with an assault rifle. All of this outrage theater around Dylan Mulvaney and Bud Light was just that. Theater. It was about how politically potent rage itself is, but it actually did real damage. Dylan Mulvaney has been stalked. She has gotten death threats and she has gotten bomb threats. Her entire life has been turned upside down. Multiple Anheuser-Busch facilities, the maker of Bud Light, received bomb threats. But for Kid Rock and conservative politicians and Fox News, that part didn't really matter. They ginned up outrage from the base, and then they moved on to their next target. Rinse and repeat.
I didn't know what hat I was wearing. We got bigger targets. I mean, when you look at who just Planet Fitness, like, what are they doing? Like,
Kid Rock's new target is apparently Planet Fitness. The gym chain is facing backlash right now after the social media influencer account Libs of TikTok riled up conservatives about the gym's trans-inclusive restroom policies. And now, Planet Fitness locations across the country are getting bomb threats. Does this mean that Kid Rock will never again visit another Planet Fitness? Who can know? Maybe he worked out there this morning. I have no idea. The facts here are not the point. The outrage is the point. Earlier this week, Donald Trump did his own version of this. In a speech to supporters in Grand Rapids, Michigan, Trump told the crowd that he had spoken to the family of a woman named Ruby Garcia, who was allegedly killed by an immigrant last month. The family, though, says that never happened. Trump also told a horror story in that speech about how three immigrants had, in his words, been soliciting sex from children. Turns out that story was also not true. Right now, the RNC has a website called BidenBloodbath.com that lists crimes by immigrants against U.S. citizens. And nowhere on the website does it mention that immigrants are statistically significantly less likely to commit crimes than native-born citizens. But hey, if it is useful and it is a great bit of outrage theater, what does the truth really matter?
Perfectly.
Coming up, a new jobs report today makes it official. Biden-era job growth has now doubled that of the Trump era. Will he get credit? We're going to discuss coming up right after the break. Did you catch these headlines today? They were really good. The U.S. economy rolls on, adds 303,000 jobs in March. Strong U.S. labor market underpins economy in first quarter. Unemployment falls to 3.8% in March as labor market continues to impress. This is President Biden's economy, the world's best, according to the experts. An economy as strong as this one until recently would have been a pretty solid case for re-election. Instead, since 2020, Biden has suffered an across-the-board drop in ratings on everything from his likability to his ability to run the government. Susan Glasser, writing for The Atlantic, says it's part of a global trend where politics have turned increasingly toxic for presidents seeking re-election. She writes, "The American presidency is the ultimate easy target. Whether high gas prices due to the Russian invasion of Ukraine or post-pandemic inflation at the grocery store, Biden absorbed the outrage while the mitigating steps taken by his administration have not redounded to his credit. Republicans, meanwhile, are free to blast away at the president without having to do anything to fix the problem, perhaps the greatest perk of being out of power. The incumbency bind is a real problem for Biden in 2024. So, too, is the political amnesia powering the increasingly absurd arguments from Trump and his enablers. Forgetting is one of the former president's political superpowers. Call it Trump's amnesia advantage." Joining me now is Susan Glasser, staff writer for The New Yorker. It is great to see you, Susan. I do wonder, as we talk about the phenomenon of this Trump amnesia advantage, how much you think of it is born on the back of COVID trauma, whether or not Americans' desire to sort of put in a box what happened in those years has allowed Trump to pretend like nothing bad actually happened and he was a much better president than the facts would suggest.
You know, even if you put aside the craziness of 2020, Alex, right? Like, oh my goodness, you know, there's so much to talk about the madness and dislocation of every other year of the Trump presidency, even if COVID never happened. I think it speaks to me once again to Trump's skills, certainly as a marketer, as a brander, as a self-promoter. He's convinced so many people, I think, including a lot of people who don't like Donald Trump, that somehow he had the greatest economy in the history of the world. That's not true, by the way, but it speaks to the powers of repetition. He is nothing if not a skilled propagandist. That's one thing. More broadly, there is, if you look at it, a long-term trend predating Trump in American politics and actually around the industrialized world. These are sour times in many of these electorates. Doug Sosnick, the Democratic strategist, Bill Clinton's White House political director, he found that the Americans have voted against the party in power in 10 out of the last 12 elections. There is really almost, instead of an incumbency advantage that American presidents used to have, you know, campaigning from the Rose Garden and the like, it's almost the opposite now. It's an incumbency disadvantage, I think, that President Biden is looking at. And the deep unpopularity of many incumbents, not just this particular one.
It seems like if you talk about history, ex-presidents often have a sort of glow that coalesces around them as the years pass, right? And certainly that seems to be happening no matter with Trump, no matter how appalling his 4 years in office were. But the fact of the matter is he's a candidate again. It's not like he's retired. And the stuff he's saying right now is equally appalling. I guess I wonder why you think the amnesia from his years past extends to the sort of forgiveness of his lack of coherent policy or any policy at all that would make sense other than xenophobic and bigoted, immigration rhetoric.
Well, I think this is where you see the task of the current White House very clearly in 2024, which is to say, if they don't manage to turn this away from being a referendum on Biden and being much more of a choice between Biden and Trump, I think they're going to continue to be in trouble electorally. There's a strong sense that when faced with a choice, many Americans might not choose Donald Trump, but that right now, part of the reason for Biden's low ratings is that they're focusing on him and his record and him as the incumbent and him as the vehicle for the dissatisfaction. Remember that for much of the last 20 years, large majorities of the American electorate have said that the country's going in the wrong direction. And so that's a huge headwind for any incumbent. So they have to turn it into a story, I think, and into an election about Donald Trump, which is where the forgetting comes in. I hear amazing things, Alex, even from people who don't like Donald Trump. They said, I had one person say to me recently, a young person who clearly doesn't like Trump, well, wow, did you know that he was considering, you know, using the Insurrection Act against Americans? And I thought, did you forget 2020 entirely? Have you just written that out of your consciousness? It's amazing to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would just say, and I understand the sort of political realities of making this a referendum on Trump, but it's not as if good things aren't happening right now for this White House. I mean, the jobs numbers are the best they've been since the 1960s, right? And the reality is that a lot of the money that was allocated for these infrastructure projects is finally coming into use in swing states and red states across the country. So I guess it really feels like unfair, to put it bluntly, for this president to have to somehow, you know, push his sizable achievements off stage left because he needs to talk about Donald Trump more. I mean, do you not think that there's any way for Biden to make a stronger case for his incumbency as the economic news in particular gets better through the rest of this campaign year?
Well, it's a good question. I'm not a seer. I'm just looking at what's in front of me. And I agree that that's one of the paradoxes of this political moment, isn't it? But remember, the Biden White House spent much of last year on a campaign to do just what you're talking about. Remember Bidenomics and going around the country trying to sell the president's many legislative achievements to Americans. There's no evidence to suggest that it improved his particular personal poll standing at all after a year of campaigning to do that. There's certainly evidence that suggests that Democrats as a party are doing pretty well right now, but it so far hasn't yet seemed to translate into the prospects for the president himself.
The night is young, Susan Glasser. We are going to see how it all shapes up. Thank you for joining me this Friday night. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
That is our show for tonight.